think. I was told that the family wanted an examination of the head, as I recall, the head and chest, but the prosecutors in this autopsy didn't remove the organs of the neck, to my recollection. Oser, you have said they did not. I want to know, why didn't you, as an autopsy pathologist, attempt to ascertain the track through the body which you had on the autopsy table in trying to ascertain the cause or causes of death? Why? Fink, I had the cause of death. Oser, why did you not trace the track of the wound? Fink, as I recall, I didn't remove these organs from the neck. Oser, I didn't hear you. Fink, I examined the wounds, but I didn't remove the organs of the neck. Oser, you said you didn't do this. I am asking you why you didn't do this as a pathologist. Fink, from what I recall, I looked at the trachea. There was a tracheotomy wound, the best I can remember, but I didn't dissect or remove these organs. Oser, Your Honor, I would ask Your Honor to direct the witness to answer my question. I will ask you the question one more time. Why did you not dissect the track of the bullet wound that you have described today and you saw at the time of the autopsy, at the time you examined the body? Why? I ask you to answer that question. Fink, as I recall, I was told not to, but I don't remember by whom. Oser, you were told not to, but you don't remember by whom? Fink, right. Oser, could it have been one of the admirals or one of the generals in the room? Fink, I don't recall. Oser, do you have any particular reason why you cannot recall at this time? Fink, because we were told to examine the head and the chest cavity, and that doesn't include the removal of the organs of the neck. Oser, you are one of the three autopsy specialists and pathologists at the time, and you saw what you described as an entrance wound in the neck area of the President of the United States, who had just been assassinated, and you were only interested in the other wound, but not interested in the track through his neck. Is that what you're telling me? Dr. Fink, I was interested in the track, and I had observed the conditions of bruising between the point of entry in the back of the neck and the point of exit at the front of the neck, which is entirely compatible with the bullet path. Oser, but you were told not to go into the area of the neck. Is that your testimony? Dr. Fink, from what I recall, yes, but I don't remember by whom.
Okay, now, basically, what we're just looking at there is the military, again, affecting a key degree of control over the autopsy results with regard to the assassination of President Kennedy, again, an overthrow of the legitimate government of the United States. This essentially puts us right back in the same framework that we were in at the end of the last broadcast. Now, what we'd like to do is to pick up and develop a theme that we were developing at that time, namely, looking at the John Birch Society.
All righty. Well, that concludes that particular section of Radio Free America program number 12. Again, the third Radio Free America broadcast in a four-part series dealing with the Aryan nations. It looks both at the development of Nazism here in the United States since 1934, and in particular looks at the Aryan nations neo-Nazi umbrella group, takes a look at their connections to the national security establishment, and analyzes them as, in fact, an extension of that national security establishment. We're now going to add to the archives concerning Vietnam the next two articles that I'm going to be reading are going to go into the archives as a miscellaneous archive show. It'll probably be entitled The Hidden History of the Vietnam War, or The Secret History of the Origins of the Vietnam War. I don't know exactly what the title will be, but in any event, it's going to consist of an analysis of the Gulf of Tonkin incident. Now, we've already looked at how President Kennedy's assassination basically paved the way for our involvement in Vietnam. It canceled Kennedy's order to withdraw from Vietnam, that in NSA 263. It provided for troop levels at least equal to those during the Diem regime, thereby canceling the troop withdrawal. And beyond that, more importantly, it provided for the 34A program of covert operations against North Vietnam, which was to result in the Gulf of Tonkin incident and the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. Now, in a nutshell, in August of 1964, two U.S. destroyers over a couple of days were supposedly fired on by North Vietnamese patrol craft in international waters. This was used as the pretext, first of all, for some airstrikes against North Vietnam. Beyond that, on August 7th of 64, the U.S. Congress passed the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. What this did was to authorize President Johnson to introduce such forces or to take such steps in Southeast Asia as he felt was warranted or were warranted in order to protect U.S. forces there. Under the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, some 650,000 regular U.S. military personnel ultimately wound up in Vietnam in the Vietnam War. Now, it later came out, first of all, that the destroyers Maddox and C. Turner Joy were actually in North Vietnamese territorial waters, not international waters, as they had claimed, and beyond that, they had been covering for covert operations against North Vietnam, which had not been disclosed to the public. In other words, basically, the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, which circumvented Congress's constitutional authority to declare war, only the Congress can declare war according to the U.S. Constitution, well, basically, that authority was subverted by the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. As we shall see, the Gulf of Tonkin incident itself was fraudulent. We're going to take a look at an article now that comes from the San Jose Metro, their issue of August 17th through 23rd of 1989. This is an article by Michael Miner, M-I-N-E-R. It's in the hard copy column. It's called War Story, subheaded The Lie That Launched 1,000 Ships. This is an account by Hoover Institute fellow James Bond Stockdale, a vice admiral who, at the time of the Gulf of Tonkin incident, was a U.S. carrier pilot and had absolutely irrefutable evidence that the Gulf of Tonkin incident was a fraud, that basically there was no evidence the U.S. was attacked and we were going to war under fraudulent auspices. A little over a year later, he was shot down over North Vietnam and became a prisoner of the Vietnamese. The implications of that are discussed here as follows. And again, this fellow, I guess, I don't know whether he's still at the Hoover Institute at the time of the writing of this, about a year ago. Again, this is August 17th through 23rd of 1989. I'm reading this on August 19th of 1990. Michael Miner's article, War Story, The Lie That Launched 1,000 Ships, about Vice Admiral James Bond Stockdale. Last week was the 25th anniversary of the shameful day when mendacity swept America into its longest war. On August 7th, 1964, the two houses of Congress passed Lyndon Johnson's Tonkin Gulf Resolution by a combined vote of 504-2. The resolution was sort of an experiment. The idea wasn't to call war war and see if in that way it could be waged without agitating the public. And this approach had its benefits. It left congressmen free to insist later that war was never what they had in mind. It left Lyndon Johnson free to bomb Vietnam, yet to campaign against Barry Goldwater as a peace candidate. For the resolution did no more than authorize the president, quote, to take all necessary measures to repel any armed attack against the forces of the United States and to prevent further aggression, unquote. The language was boilerplate, furnished by Assistant Secretary of Defense William Bundy months before in anticipation of an appropriate provocation. The last sentence again. The language was boilerplate, furnished by Assistant Secretary of Defense William Bundy months before in anticipation of an appropriate provocation. By the way, his brother, then National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy, was the fellow who signed NSA 273 as well as 263. Continuing with the account. The provocation that came along was double-barreled. On August 2nd, 1964, an American destroyer, the USS Maddox, was attacked by a North Vietnamese patrol boat a few miles off the coast of North Vietnam. 2 days later, the Maddox and a second destroyer, the Turner Joy, reported a renewed attack. The Maddox had not been sailing innocently along when it came under fire. It had been hugging the shore to monitor communist radio traffic during a South Vietnamese commando raid. This complicity remained a secret because when Secretary of State Dean Rusk and Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara testified before Congress on the need for the resolution, both men lied. And Congress wasn't told that the second attack never happened at all. A malfunctioning radar, freakish weather conditions, and jumpy nerves caused the two destroyers to open fire on an enemy that wasn't there. Soon, Lyndon Johnson realized it. Quote, hell, LBJ said a few days later. Those dumb, stupid sailors were just shooting at flying fish, unquote. But we were in the war. Today, Vice Admiral James Bond Stockdale, S-T-O-C-K-D-A-L-E, is a 65-year-old fellow of Stanford's Hoover Institution who writes books and papers with such titles as On Public Virtue, unquote. The night of the attack that never was, Commander Stockdale crisscrossed a lightning-raked sky in his F-8 Crusader, scouring the South China Sea for enemy boats to point his guns at. He found none. A few hours later, when the president ordered reprisals and Stockdale went back up to lead a bombing raid on a North Vietnamese oil dump at Vinh, he recognized the fiction being written. Not that war bothered him. All the signs pointed to war in Southeast Asia sooner or later, and Stockdale, however intellectual his cast of mind, was a warrior. Yet shouldn't war, of all things, be entered on the square? Quote, the bad portents of the moment were suffocating, unquote, he'd recall years later in the memoir of Love and War. We were about to launch a war under false pretenses. 13 months after the Vinh raid, Stockdale was shot down and captured and put in a terrible spot. As he'd write, quote, I was in possession of the most damaging information a North Vietnamese torturer could possibly extract from an American prisoner of war. The legal basis of the war was illegitimate. Everyone knew that already but the American people, and Stockdale understood that he could be turned into the propaganda coup of the war. For the 7.5 years he was captive, he protected his secret any way he could, going so far at one point as to attempt suicide. Skipping down in the article, when he'd landed the night of the raid, that's the alleged attack on the Maddox, when he landed that night, he made a full report. When the Pentagon, days after the resolution cleared Congress, sent a couple of men out to his ship to put it to him straight away, were there any effing boats out there the other night or not, unquote, Stockdale had said no, there weren't. He'd told Navy friends what really happened. But in the few months allotted to him to put the truth before the country, he hadn't. So we put down the book on John Paul Vann and wrote Stockdale a letter asking him why. Your insistent question, he wrote back, about why I did not notify the American people about the documentary inaccuracies behind the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, that is to say, the absence of an attack on the Maddox and Joy on the night of August 4th, 1964, seems to ignore the practicalities of what a person in my position could do, unquote. The emphases are his. Again quoting, I was on active duty, out of the country, a voice in the wilderness. There was no problem with my conscience. I had done the right thing. I had reported no boats to my ship, and when my ship had accurately forwarded my report to the right office in Washington at the highest priority. It was received there 12 hours before the reprisal at Vinh occurred. Those last two sentences again. I had reported no boats to my ship, and my ship had accurately forwarded my report to the right office in Washington at the highest priority. It was received there 12 hours before the reprisal at Vinh occurred. Quote, there are still people in Washington who put out government documents insisting that I, and dozens of other eyewitnesses, are wrong, and when pressed hide behind, quote, highly classified, unavailable sources, unquote, all of which I know to be BS, that prove they were right after all. Stockdale wrote, quote, there are some very big names who are fighting for their lifelong reputations over this one. The insiders say there will not be a free flow of truth on this until the last of them are in their graves, unquote. That last sentence there, that last observation by Admiral Stockdale, goes back to the phrase that I quote so often on this broadcast, how many lies can you allow yourself to believe before you belong to the lie? And again, the fact of the matter is there are an awful lot of people who literally have a lot invested in terms of both money and reputation in perpetuating the various lies concerning American history, ranging from the assassinations of John and Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and others, up to the fraudulent history of the Vietnam War. And again, I think that article pretty much speaks for itself concerning what the Gulf of Tonkin incident was, what was maintained to have happened, what really happened. There was supposedly an attack on two destroyers. There was, in fact, no attack. The boats were not in international waters, but North Vietnamese territorial waters. And beyond that, they were supporting some of the covert actions against North Vietnam, which had been suspended by President Kennedy in NSA 249 from June 25th of 63, and which were then authorized by NSA 273 from November 26th of 1963. We're now going to take a look at some of the raids that were conducted in connection with the Gulf of Tonkin incident, and specifically we're going to take a look at the raid on Han Mae Island, and we're going to hear a first-person account from one of the participants in that raid. This fellow was a fellow named Elton Manzioni, or Manzione, M-A-N-Z-I-O-N-E. He was a Navy SEAL, that is to say, a Navy commando, and he was involved in a raid on this island. The raid, again, was Han Mae Island, spelled H-O-N, capital M-E. There was a North Vietnamese radar station and military installation on this island. That radar installation was the purported target of their attack. As we're going to see in this incident, it is Manzione's opinion, and I think the facts argue strongly in this regard, that in fact his group was deliberately dropped at the wrong end of the island so that they would activate North Vietnamese defenses so that the electronic countermeasures people on board the USS Maddox could electronically fingerprint the North Vietnamese radar frequencies. And he compares this later to the KAL 007 incident, the downing of Korean Airlines Flight 007. Research credit on this excellent article goes to a diligent listener. This comes from the National Reporter, their issue of spring of 1987. That now defunct publication used to be called Counter Spy. This is the raid on Han Mae. It's co-authored by Doug Valentine and Elton Manzioni. Copyright 1986 by Douglas Valentine. Elton Manzioni is the SEAL whose narrative follows in this particular article. I'm going to read you the introduction, and then we're going to skip down into the article itself. For over 20 years, the events surrounding the Gulf of Tonkin incident have been steeped in mystery. Certainly, President Lyndon Johnson used it as a pretext to broaden America's involvement in the Vietnam War. But was the incident, as many historians have suspected, a deliberate provocation on the part of the United States? This article, which is based on the recollections of an American who actually participated in the raid on Han Mae Island, reveals for the first time the true extent of U.S. involvement in the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And not only does it prove that the incident was a deliberate provocation, but it also serves as a reminder that truth is the first casualty when a nation decides to go to war. And I want to issue a cautionary note here. I'm going to read this section of the article as it is written. Obviously, where the F word is used, I'm not going to read that on the air because for FCC purposes, you will hear several references here to, quote, gooks, unquote. I want to emphasize that this is soldier talk. It is contained in the context of the article, so I want to apologize in advance to those members of the listening audience who are of Oriental extraction. I do not mean any racial insult. However, I think for purposes of verisimilitude, I'm going to read you the account as it is related by one of the participants, and that includes, so to speak, GI slang. So a cautionary note in advance. Skipping down in the article, the actual section dealing with, well, there's a lot of discussion about the SEALs and their training and their combat experience and some of Manzione's other experiences. The actual section of the article dealing with the raid on Han Mae Island begins as follows. Upon arriving at Qua Viet, capital C-U-A, capital V-I-E-T, the SEALs were quartered in a Navy officer's billet and told two missions were in the works. The first was a raid against Hongio Island, H-O-N-G-I-O Island, Tiger Island, which occurred around July 20th, and which Elton participated, although he wasn't part of the team they put ashore. Now, July 20th here is, of course, 1964. The details of the second mission were outlined a few days later at a briefing given by a Navy officer whose name may have been Peterson. This officer told Elton, that's Elton Manzioni, the SEAL whose account is presented here, this officer told Elton and Van Lesser, one of his buddies, that they would be picked up by boat at Qua Viet, taken up the coast of North Vietnam, and then would advise a party of South Vietnamese going ashore to blow up a radar installation on Han Mae Island. Having just returned from a similar raid, Elton had no reason to doubt the Han Mae raid wouldn't be a repeat performance. The Han Mae briefing happened July 24th or 25th. 2 days later, and this is where the plot starts to thicken, Elton received a letter from a friend he'd gone to CT school with. The friend, who was very excited at the prospect of seeing some action, said he'd been assigned to the Maddox, and that the Maddox was going to patrol off the coast of Vietnam. Now this is a coincidence, Elton states emphatically, again quoting, He didn't even know I was in Vietnam, let alone going up the coast to Hanoi Mae while he was in the Maddox monitoring the North Vietnamese response. He thought I was still in effing Norfolk, Virginia, so he mentions the thing about the black box. He says there are 15 CT people who aren't part of the ship's company, that they're detached personnel, and that they're doing electronic monitoring. He said as much as he could get away with, unquote. The black box was a device that could pick up radio signals other than those beamed directly to it, and could pick up radar signals other than its own. At the time, however, Elton didn't give the letter much thought. He assumed the Navy was censoring mail, so he didn't think his friend was leaking anything important. Plus which, he already knew the aircraft carrier Ticonderoga was in the South China Sea, and he knew the Navy was running operations, so it just didn't strike him as extraordinary. That is, not until a few days later. On July 30th, 1964, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Elton and Van Lesser went to the piers at Qua Viet. Four boats pulled in from Da Nang. They boarded one. Two boats immediately took off for Han Nu Island, which also got hit that night. And we went to Hanoi Mae, Elton says, us and the other boat, unquote. There were five Americans on the boat Elton and Van Lesser boarded, and about the same number of Americans on the other boat. Both boats were piloted by Navy personnel in civilian clothes. There were also CIA agents aboard. Elton didn't recognize any of the Americans, nor were they introduced to him, but he was introduced to a captain in the South Vietnamese Marines. 10 or 12 South Vietnamese Marines wearing Sat Kong Kill Commie patches were wandering around the deck. Everyone was a little apprehensive. Instead of going below decks right away, Elton and Van Lesser walked around and looked at the boat, and contrary to most authoritative, unquote, accounts of the Gulf of Tonkin incident, they were not swift boats. They were 80 feet long. They were 80 foot long Norwegian-built PT boats called Nasties, capable of holding 20 men. Equipped with 57mm recoilless rifles, 40mm anti-aircraft guns, and 20mm cannons, the Nasties were more heavily armed and much larger than the Swifts, which are only 50 feet long and hold only 6 crewmen. After inspecting the boat and meeting the SV Marine captain, Elton and Van Lesser were taken below decks and, for the first time, given detailed maps showing where the radar installation was located on Hanoi Mae Island. They were told, again for the first time, that they were going to take in 4 boatloads of South Vietnamese Marines, each of these boats being a relatively small 5-man rubber craft. Counting Elton and Van Lesser, the attack team numbered 22 men. The two SEALs changed into black pajamas, as did the South Vietnamese Marines, and they all applied camo paint. That, of course, is camouflage paint. Elton always carried a black bandana to tie around his hair. He put it on. Meanwhile, the two nasty boats were cruising way out into the Gulf of Tonkin, approaching their destination in a wide arch, in that way avoiding detection by the hundreds of fishing boats strung out along the North Vietnamese coast. Traveling at a speed of close to 60 miles per hour, the Nasties left Qua Viet at approximately 4 p.m. and arrived at Hanoi Mae Island at 11:45 p.m., taking nearly 8 hours to reach what would normally have taken 3 had they traveled in a straight line. Final preparations were made. 5 or 6 automatic weapons were wrapped in cloth and placed in each raft, including some grease guns and some German G3s. None of the weapons were current American. 3 satchel charges, each one composed of 8 pounds of C4 explosives, were also put in each raft. Elton carried a 9mm automatic pistol and his Gerber. He never went anywhere without his Gerber. That's a knife, I believe, a combat knife. The two Nasties went in full bore toward the island with their lights out, on the first pass dropping the rubber commando rafts into the water, 2 rafts from each boat. Making a circle, they came back around for a second pass, again moving at full bore, and this time the 22 commandos jumped over the sides into the sea. They swam to the rafts and climbed in while the Nasties stood off about 100 yards away, drifting broadside to the coast. Quote, "We're talking about the southeastern end of Hanoi Mae Island," Elton is careful to point out, again quoting. "The coastline was a little rough, but the weather was all right. The seas were running a little high, and the coastline was a little rough, but the weather was good. We paddle maybe 80 yards offshore, and I don't see the effing radar installation. There's these 4 rubber rafts strung out maybe 15 yards apart, and I'm looking out, but I don't see anything. Van Lesser is on the raft, anchoring the other end of the line of rafts. He paddles around and asks, quote, "Do you see the radar installation?" I say, "No, I don't see an effing thing," unquote. Ideally, the raiding party should have been dropped exactly where the radar installation was situated, no matter what the weather conditions were, no matter what the coastline was like. Indeed, Elton and Van Lesser had been told they would be dropped as close to the radar station as possible, but that's not what happened. Quote, "So there's a little doubt in my mind," Elton recalls uneasily, and again quoting, "and there's a little bit of talk. Van Lesser is talking to an American-speaking Vietnamese in his raft, and that guy is talking in Vietnamese to another guy in one of the other rafts, and then everybody is looking at effing maps, and we figure out they've dropped us on the wrong end of the island." This last paragraph again. "So there's a little doubt in my mind," unquote, Elton recalls uneasily, again quoting, "and there's a little bit of talk. Van Lesser is talking to an American-speaking Vietnamese in his raft, and that guy is talking in Vietnamese to another guy in one of the other rafts, and then everybody is looking at effing maps, and we figure out they've dropped us on the wrong end of the island," unquote. To make matters worse, they didn't have radios, so they couldn't contact the Nasties to explain the mistake. And although Elton and Van Lesser had not requested radios, this was not an oversight on their part. They hadn't known exactly what they were going to be doing until they got on the boats. Prior to that, they'd been told they were going to be advisors for an amphibious attack on an island, but no one had ever mentioned that they were going to be in the rafts leading the assault. That particular detail had been conspicuously neglected. A decision had to be made. The raiding party had a specific rendezvous time with the Nasties. They had 3 hours to get in, blow the radar installation, and get back out. But Elton and Van Lesser were afraid to go paddling back out prematurely on the off chance the people in the Nasties would think they were North Vietnamese coming out to attack and would start shooting at them. According to Elton, the ensuing conversation went something like this. "So," Van Lesser asked, "what the hell are we going to do?" unquote. Again quoting, "I guess the only thing we can do is paddle around the effing island," Elton replied. "Do you think we'll be late?" "Well, no, they've given us plenty of time." "Okay, we'll try that. So how do you want to do it? Do you want to paddle around the island and look for a good spot to land and go in cross-country? Or do you want to paddle around the island until we get where they got the radar installation?" Unquote. Quickly, the Americans decided to paddle around the island until they got a visual sighting of the radar installation. Then, no matter where they were, if it looked like a good place to hit the beach, they hit the beach and go in the rest of the way on foot. In reaching this decision, they'd taken into consideration the fact that Han Mae is only 2.5 miles long, at most. "So we start paddling up the coast of Han Mae," Elton explains, "and the Navy boats apparently do have somewhat of a visual sighting on us, either that or they're drifting, because they're staying fairly close to us, and from what we think, we can see." Was that the top of the boat? Is the sort of thing that gets said as we're bobbing up and down on the waves that night, or was it a wave? We get to where we've got the radar station within sight. It's a flat island except for a few little parts where it's steep, and one of those parts that's steep is where the radar station is located. We're coming up from the south, and the radar station is around the point on the other side, and it sits up on a little high spot. We get there, and that's when the expletive deleted hits the fan. They pop the effing lights on us and start shooting, and we immediately end up with two boats with holes in them. That, of course, popping on the lights, that's the North Vietnamese. Again, quoting, "We're sitting in this inflatable rubber raft, and the one beside us is going psst, so hurriedly we paddle out, and weapons are dropping in the water, and guys are hitting the water and swimming over to the other two boats and hanging on the tiny ropes on the sides. So essentially what you have now are 22 men clinging on to 2 5-man rafts with the entire island waking up and shooting because Han Mae is not just an island. It's a military installation island. In fact, that's all it is. So we're trying to get the F out of there, paddling like mad, as you can well imagine, and the Nasty boats finally pick up that all is not well in jungle land. We do have flashlights, so when they come back around for a second look, Van Lesser gives them the signal with the flashlight to stand by and pick up the amphibious team. Quote, "Well, we have a hard time getting the gooks in the water because probably some of them can't swim very well, but we got to get them in the water because the only way you can pick up on a high-speed run is you can't stop and pick up the boats. I mean, we're talking about one of the catches with the damn rubber loop that you grab hold of as it goes by. And we're trying to get them into the water and in a line so they can be picked up. In the meantime, it's obvious the Americans on the boat are running the show because we're not having a problem communicating by light. But we are having a hell of a time getting the gooks to shuck their equipment and get into the water. So we're throwing little inflatable vests to the ones who can't stay afloat, and people are popping them open and putting them on, all this while the North Vietnamese are shooting at us. Bullets are whizzing around, and the nasty boats have started returning fire as they go around. Finally, we get everyone in a nice long line and start getting picked up. Now what's happening during the pickup is that one of the boats is doing the pickup while the other one is laying down cover fire. Then they switch. After one boat picked up as many people as it could, they switched off. Simple. I get on one of the boats. There's the South Vietnamese captain talking with an American, and they're arguing about what they're going to do next, stay or go. The American is telling the South Vietnamese captain that if we run, the North Vietnamese might intercept us farther down the coast because we're 175 miles north of the DMZ. He says what we ought to do is zap the North Vietnamese while we can. That seems to be the consensus, so we spend perhaps another half hour there shelling the island with 57mm recoilless rifles and 20mm and 40mm cannons. We expend I don't know how many hundreds of rounds, and then we do the same run back that we did going up. We go out into the Gulf of Tonkin in a very wide sweep, then we come back in just as we pass below the 17th parallel. And they drop me and Van Lesser back at the piers at Qua Viet, and they say, take a week's vacation. Take a little time off. Unquote. Qua Viet was not a very big town in the summer of 1964. There was no railroad set up for servicemen. And there was no place to go. One more time. Qua Viet was not a very big town in the summer of 1964. There was no railroad set up for servicemen, and there was no place to go. During his 10-month tour in Vietnam, Elton had a grand total of 3 days R&R, which he spent in Hue. He never saw Saigon. Plus which, an American back there stood out like a sore thumb, like the Marines that got greased in El Salvador. Although Elton never had any attempts on his life, we did hear through military intelligence, which had heard through its Vietnamese civilian agent net, that there was a reward for himself and the other members of the SEAL team who had been carrying out the counter-terror business. After the SEALs had run 3 sniping missions on General Giap's field-grade officers in a period of 2 weeks, the word went out that if you brought back the head of a SEAL, you'd get a $500 reward. So, like SEALs flying around the Middle East nowadays, Elton and his SEAL comrades were unwelcome visitors who, as a matter of self-preservation, were compelled to keep a very low profile. Consequently, Elton and Van Lesser never ventured far from the Navy officer's billet, and while they lingered there, the scuttlebutt spread that the two of them had made an over-the-fence, unquote, raid into North Vietnam. The people at Qua Viet who were inferring this were the CT people picking up on the radio traffic in the South China Sea. In fact, the CTs were monitoring the Maddox on the morning of July 31st when it broadcast that it had been approached by 3 Soviet P-6 torpedo boats, which is why the CTs at Qua Viet at first thought the nasties were enemy ships when they pulled into port. But once that case of mistaken identity had been resolved, it wasn't hard for the CTs to conclude that Elton and Van Lesser, who stepped off the boats, which then proceeded to Da Nang, were involved in some sort of clandestine operation. One that, the last sentence again. But once that case of mistaken identity had been resolved, it wasn't hard for the CTs to conclude that Elton and Van Lesser, who stepped off the boats, which then proceeded to Da Nang, were involved in some sort of clandestine operation. I don't know if they knew exactly what had happened, Elton says, but they do know we went on a commando raid. We're sitting down at the club one afternoon. It was an officers and EMs club, and a couple of guys came in and sat down with us. We were having drinks and talking about how things were starting to get exciting, seeing as how the North Vietnamese were claiming they'd been invaded, and one of the guys said, quote, we heard you guys went on an interesting mission the other night, unquote. Of course, we're not supposed to say anything at all about it, so we say, no, we just went on a coastal patrol, unquote. So the other guy comes back the following day and says, yeah? Well, they had another of those coastal patrols. I said, yeah, and he says, yeah, they got a radar installation in Vinh Son and a security installation at Mui Ron, the last name M-U-I, capital R-O-N. Vinh Son and Mui Ron, incidentally, are 2 areas in between Hon Mae and the DMZ, but they're not islands, they're promontories. They're part of North Vietnam's mainland. They got hit August 3rd. The next day, August 4th, the Maddox nearly blew the Turner Joy out of the water. But more importantly, the Maddox claimed to have been attacked by North Vietnamese torpedo boats, called in air support, and proceeded to engage in a full-scale battle with figments created by false radar imagery. At no time on August 4th was the Maddox able to lock its radar onto surface targets. When the news of the so-called North Vietnamese attack was made public after U.S. warplanes bombed North Vietnam for what Secretary of Defense McNamara called unprovoked and deliberate attacks in international waters against our naval vessels, unquote, Elton finally drew the inevitable conclusion. He remembered about his friend and the black box on the Maddox. He realized that getting dumped on the wrong end of Han May Island was not an intelligence failure, but that the people running the show wanted the raiding party to be detected so the North Vietnamese would activate their early warning system, thus enabling the Maddox, which was only a few miles away, to fingerprint, quote-unquote, the North Vietnamese radar frequencies, so those frequencies could be scrambled during the U.S. air attacks on August 5th. Repeating those last few sentences, Elton finally drew the inevitable conclusion. He remembered about his friend and the black box on the Maddox. He realized that getting dumped on the wrong end of Han May Island was not an intelligence failure, but that the people running the show wanted the raiding party to be detected so the North Vietnamese would activate their early warning system, thus enabling the Maddox, which was only a few miles away, to fingerprint, quote-unquote, the North Vietnamese radar frequencies, so those frequencies could be scrambled during the U.S. air attacks on August 5th. Quoting, "That's standard procedure for intelligence gathering operations," Elton asserts. "Send us in to trip the security, so I was just a little burned. Van Lesser, too," unquote. But Van Lesser, of course, didn't have a friend on the Maddox telling him how the Maddox picked up a MacSog intelligence officer on Taiwan just before heading into the Tonkin Gulf. Elton alone was in a unique position to put his part in the raid on Han May into a larger frame. Quite independently, he came to see how he and Van Lesser and the 20 South Vietnamese Marines had served as the trigger mechanism in a pre-planned series of events designed to provoke the North Vietnamese. Quoting, "But the most important thing I found out from my friend on the Maddox," Elton says, noting that he received this information several years after the event, "was that the black box, the communications receiving equipment, went on alert at 11 p.m. the night of July 30th, an hour before we went in, meaning whoever was handling the whole operation was notified in advance and was preparing to monitor the North Vietnamese radar transmitters." That last paragraph again. "But the most important thing I found out from my friend on the Maddox," Elton says, noting that he received this information several years after the event, "was that the black box, quote-unquote, the communications receiving equipment, went on alert at 11 p.m. the night of July 30th, an hour before we went in, meaning whoever was handling the whole operation was notified in advance and was preparing to monitor the North Vietnamese radar transmitters." Considering that the Gulf of Tonkin resolution had been prepared months before the incident by McGeorge Bundy's staff as normal, quote, contingency planning, unquote, Elton's experience confirms I.F. Stone's characterization of the Gulf of Tonkin incident as a, quote, question not just of decision-making in a crisis, but of crisis-making to support a secretly prearranged decision. McNamara and Tonkin Bay, The Unanswered Questions, New York Review of Books, March 28, 1968, page 11 is the reference. Again, continuing with the narrative. Even though it was a fabricated incident, the U.S. Congress went along for the ride, voting overwhelmingly on August 7th to allow President Johnson to take all the necessary measures to repel any armed attacks against forces of the United States to prevent further aggression, unquote. Through deception and high technology, the U.S. government, through deception and high technology, the U.S. government managed to convince the public, the press, and the Congress that the Maddox and Turner Joy were the innocent victims of attacks by trigger-happy North Vietnamese, when actually the presence of the Maddox and Turner Joy was anything but benign. On the night of July 30th through 31st, the black box, quote-unquote, on the Maddox was measuring the North Vietnamese response to the aborted raid on Han May Island. For instance, who was calling whom, where the calls were going, how often the calls were being sent, how soon the raid had been noticed, how it was noticed, and what noticed it. Furthermore, on August 4th, the Maddox simply relayed the wrong radar data, data having its origin in the black box, quote unquote. Again quoting, the same thing happened with KAL-007, Elton declares. KAL-007, that's Korean Airlines Flight 007, shot down by the Soviets, although it's questionable at this point whether it was actually shot down by the Soviets or blown up by a bomb. We'll talk about that at some other time, perhaps. The same thing happened with KAL-007, Elton declares. KAL-007 wasn't taking spy pictures. It wasn't doing anything other than flying over Russian territory and not answering radio calls and turning off its identity transmitter. And it was doing these suspicious things to get the Russians to lock their radar on it and radio back to their headquarters that it wasn't responding to their calls. In the meantime, there was a KC-135 in the air, not far from KAL-007, recording who called whom, etc. All of this so you, the Pentagon, get an idea of what there the Russians' radar capabilities are. You learn their chain of command, unquote. The moral being that Han Mei was not an isolated incident. And if it's happened before, God knows how many times, it can surely happen again. And that concludes the material about the raid on Han Mei Island and the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And again, this will go into the archives as a miscellaneous archive show. We'll probably call it The Secret Origins of the Vietnam War. In fact, I think that's what we will call it. This will be in as a miscellaneous archive show. People should also dovetail this information with the Guns of November number 3, dealing with the effect of President Kennedy's assassination upon our Vietnam War policy. That program was originally recorded in November of 1963. There was an important addendum to Guns of November number 3 recorded last week being August 12th of 1990. We're now going to take a musical break, and then we're going to proceed with the rest of the broadcast.